Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of Filipina-American journalist and guerrilla leader Yeh Panlilio. Born in 1913 to a Filipina mother and an Irish-American father, she moved to the Philippines in the 1930s, where she became a popular reporter, photographer, and radio broadcaster. When World War II broke out, Yeh served as an informant for the U.S. Army by encoding secret messages into her radio broadcasts. Eventually, this caught the attention of the Japanese army that occupied the Philippines, and Yeh had to flee Manila to the countryside, where she joined the famed Marking Guerrillas, one of the many Filipino guerrilla groups battling for freedom. Yeh would prove crucial to the Marking Guerrillas for planning strategies, fulfilling administrative duties, and crafting anti-Japanese propaganda, earning the title Colonel Yeh. After surviving the war, Yeh returned to the United States and continued writing. Her memoir, The Crucible, an autobiography of Colonel Yeh, Filipina-American guerrilla, was published in 1950. She was also awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Harry Truman for her services during the war. For this episode, we are joined by writer, scholar, performer, and activist Jen Soriano, author of the recent collection Nervous, Essays on Heritage and Healing. You can read more about Jen in the episode description. Jen is interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place August 22nd, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Jen, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm looking forward to talking to you about Yeh Panlilio and her work and legacy and what it means to you. Now, before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to recently?
Thanks for having me, Nate. I'm really happy to be here. And yes, my name is Jen Soriano. As you had said, I use she and they pronouns. I am based in Seattle, but I'm originally from the Chicago area. And I am a Filipinx American writer and musician, performer, and independent scholar. My debut essay collection, Nervous, Essays on Heritage and Healing, it's out now from Amistad HarperCollins, and it recently won the Memoir Prize for Books, I am very honored to say. I teach writing workshops online, and I also do speaking engagements on nonfiction craft, as well as trauma-wise healing. And I'm currently at work on my next essay collection, as well as a short story collection and a novel.
Wonderful. Thank you. It sounds like you're busy. And for our listeners, there's a link in our bio to check out Jen's book and her other work. So definitely check that out. And so tell us a little bit about Yeh Panlilio. And perhaps, do you remember when you first encountered her work?
I do. As I was writing Nervous, it took me about 8 years to write Nervous. I got kind of obsessed with finding all the memoirs written by Filipino Americans that I could possibly find. I needed examples of others who had told their own stories. And as many people say, who, you know, write about nonfiction, especially about family who are airing dirty laundry. And I needed examples to be able to find the courage to do what I was trying to do. And that's how I found Yeh Panlilio and her book, The Crucible. You know, there aren't as many examples of Filipino American memoirs as there could be, actually, because I think that Filipino American writers are more known for our fiction and our poetry. So, you know, writers like Gina Apostol and Aline Castillo and poets like Rick Barrett and Michelle Penalosa, etc. Though in terms of the memoir genre, I think listeners may be familiar with some writers like Grace Toulouson, who wrote The Body Papers, and Malika Garab, who wrote and drew the graphic memoir, I Was Their American Dream, for example. So, you know, the Filipino American memoirs do exist, but it sometimes takes some digging to find additional examples. So I did some digging, and it was through that digging that I found out about Yeh Panlilio and this reissue of her book, The Crucible, which was originally published in 1950, but was more recently reissued by editor Denise Cruz and Rutgers University Press in 2010.
Wonderful. Thank you. And that edition, I've been reading that as well. Denise Cruz does a great introduction in there and kind of laying the framework for when the book was written, or the events in which, or the events that take place in the book, when those happened, and then also the publication of it too, the timing of it, which was interesting. And to your point, kind of hard to find nowadays. So the reissue is great, and I definitely recommend checking it out. But with that in mind, perhaps now's a good time to give our listeners a little bit of that information about when Panlilio was writing, what she was writing, and the, you know, the World War II time in which she was in the Philippines. So yeah, maybe you could give us a little overview of that.
So this book came out, like I said, in 1950. And Ye Panlilio wrote it immediately after the after World War II. And so it actually stands as a, as Denise Crows writes about in her introduction to the book, as a pretty unique example of mid-20th century Filipino-American writing. And it's, you know, part of this larger body that Crews also writes about of like post-war writing that a lot of Americans were doing in terms of their experience with World War II. And obviously, I think that readers might be more familiar with a lot of that writing that came out around, you know, experiences in Europe. There were also, you know, some Americans writing about experiences in the Pacific. But Ye Panlilio's story is pretty unique in that she's a Filipina American who went to report. Well, she was a journalist already in Manila, and then she started to report on the war. And then she became a U.S. agent when the Japanese occupied Manila, essentially doing radio broadcasts that were coded information, that was included coded information that was intended to help American troops and Filipino guerrilla fighters understand what the Japanese were doing in Manila. And then eventually, when the Japanese started to find out what she was doing, then she had to go underground. And then she became part of a guerrilla outfit. She actually became part of a Filipino guerrilla unit. So this book, The Crucible, is a firsthand account of her experience during the war. And it's essentially a primary source of American and Philippine resistance to Japanese occupation during World War II. But it's also other things, and what's what makes the book so interesting. It's already interesting just given that, right? But then it's right. Also this romance between her and the guerrilla commander. But then it's also this sort of spy story, an espionage story. And she was part of essentially a circle of American spies, and many of whom were female, who also, some of whom also came out with memoirs after the war. So it's a chronicle of basically 1941 to 1945 and her experiences as a Filipina American contributing to war efforts against Japan in the Pacific theater.
Yeah, that's great, because you just did a great job of putting that in a nutshell, because there is so much in that, in The Crucible. So yeah, thank you for that. And I'm curious what, as you were, you, like you said, you read it for, as you were writing your essay collection, and which is a little bit memoir-esque, like you said as well. And so I'm curious what your experience was in reading The Crucible, and how that impacted your own writing on the, on this project and create in your creative endeavors elsewhere as well.
Thank you for asking that question. I think one of the main things that I got from reading Panlilio is more courage. You know, I had said that I was looking for examples of other Filipina American authors who were writing personal stories. And, you know, she shares so much about her life and how hard it was, as you can imagine, during a war, being a guerrilla fighter at that time, being a woman in a whole regiment of men. And so whenever I was writing my book and I got a little bit squeamish about telling truths about my own family or about myself, I would just think about her experiences and, you know, how she'd survived near starvation, was walking in the middle of the night across mountains to evade Japanese detection while having malaria, things like that. And I was like, you know what? If she could survive that and live to write about it, I can write about my relationship with my mother. You know what I mean? And so that example of, I think, feminist bravery was really important for me. And surprisingly, another thing that I got from it was the reminder to use humor and how important humor is in writing. Even when you're writing about really heavy subjects, like in my case, transgenerational trauma, and in her case, war. One of my favorite things about this book is that she writes in a way that brings you, it's the opposite of bird's eye, a ground level view of what day-to-day life was like for guerrilla fighters. And as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of intense and terrible things that she describes. But at the same time, she describes this kind of ebb and flow between vigilance and patrolling, and then joking and playing pranks on other soldiers. And, you know, later I can share a couple of my favorite quotes that actually are about humor. But basically, you know, being reminded that, especially in the hardest of times, humor is a tool of resilience was important to my writing. And so I actually went back and revised a specific essay in my book that's called 381 Years, which is about the 381 years that the Philippines was subject to colonization by the Spaniards and then by the Japanese, the United States and the Japanese. And I revised that essay to have a whole section that was specifically about humor and how throughout the resistance to erasure and division, that Filipinos always retained their sense of humor, and not only retained it, but actually really used it as a tool of resistance and resilience. And that is present throughout Panlilio's book.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the humor, because I was going to mention that as well. Because in reading your book, I found myself, despite, like you said, it's heavy topics, laughing out loud, because you do a good job of that. And that's also what I, you know, in learning about Panlilio, also her radio, you know, she made a name for herself on being that sort of feisty, funny, but still taking a cutting view and when needed to share what is really going on there, but using humor to do so. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned her feisty, you know, humorous personality. There's a part of the introduction that Denise Cruz writes that I really love, that about, actually it's a reference to the original introduction, which is also in the book, which was written by an American journalist named Kate Halliday, is I believe how you pronounce her name. And Kate knew Jay Panlilio and described her as having this sort of signature feistiness, and how she would walk around Manila before the war in like a white shark skin suit.
Yeah.
I just love that image of her as such a character. And like, I took that image of her into the scenes that she would describe where there was dialogue. She uses a lot of dialogue, and she describes dialogue between her and her lover, the guerrilla commander. And a lot of that dialogue reads like a wartime rom-com. It's just so, you know, it's just like so like snippy and kind of like snarky funny. And I would just picture her, you know, in the hills and the mountains in her shark skin suit, even though she's probably more like in rags, and just having this like witty banter with her guerrilla commander lover. And quite entertaining, actually.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned having some passages to read. Maybe now's a good time to read those out loud that will convey the sort of humor that we're talking about.
Yes. There is a section that I thought about reading, and I realized it's a bit long to read, because she was a diligent, rigorous journalist. And I imagine, though I don't know for sure, that she really had like copious notes on what came to pass. Her one of her roles in the guerrilla unit that she describes is that she was constantly using the typewriter to be able to type letters, to ask for food, to ask for support. And so I imagine that she was also maybe taking notes on dialogue, because there's just copious dialogue in here, which is one of the craft things that I really enjoy, because it just brings you into the, it brings you into the moment, almost like a screenplay. But at the same time, it can make it hard to read an excerpt, because there can be very long moments of dialogue. But I'll just describe, as I'm looking for one of the examples, that there's this one moment where she's trying to convince the guerrilla commander slash her lover to do something different than what he's going to do. Because she was, by many historical accounts, kind of the strategic brains behind the brawn of the commander. And she's making all of these reasons, arguments, lots of detailed evidence to back it up. And then meanwhile, the commander, like, all he says is no. And then she just keeps going, and she keeps going with another paragraph, and he's like, no. And this goes on for pages. And that's just like one of the moments where you're like, okay, so this is one of those like relationships where it's like two equals who kind of like have this love-hate thing going on. But
yeah.
They really help each other grow in the end. But I will read this short excerpt that is less a showing and more of a telling around the humor. And it's also an example of her fairly lyric style of describing of exposition. So this is a moment where they have just, they're just about to escape being encircled by 700 Japanese soldiers. So it's like 17 guerrillas trying to escape 700 Japanese soldiers. At 11 o'clock, a bugle sounded. Less than 3 weeks before, a bugle had brought the cavalry charge. We braced for the worst. Marking had been awake with his eyes closed. He rolled over, passed his eye, keen, quick, over the men available. Sometimes I could read his mind. I knew him so well. Late in the afternoon, we clambered down a cliff, descended a giant tree, clinging, swinging, stepping from branch to branch, to a foothold in the bank, to another branch, and so down to the dam. It wasn't dangerous. Farmers walked up and down the shortcut as if it weren't a tree at all, but it scared me. I had to be helped. Sometimes in a pinch, I could be brave. Probably because things moved so fast, there was little time for fright, but the little things could make me quail. The tree was one of them. We rested on the dam at last to clear green waters of the reservoir, cooling our eyes. Because we could not move, and because we had survived one more danger, somehow we relaxed. We found humor and play again, the saving graces of the gorilla.
Thank you for that.
Sure. And then there is this other passage. I don't know if you want, would want me to read this now or if you want to go to another topic, but it's a bit of a, like, it describes kind of like one of their nights of goofing around.
Yeah, let's go for it.
When night fell, there might be an hour with the boys around the campfire, and in that brief period, entertainment was spontaneous. Marking, who enjoyed his own stories as much as his audience, told them in the dialect with much arm and leg action, and with humor edging on the ribald. Each clique among the fighters pushed forward its own singers in good-humored competition. Good guitar music invited dancing, however rough the ground, and the burliest fighters were pressed into service as the ladies, and hilariously advised on how to lean, cling, sweep, and swoon. Here, one hobbling on a cut foot, never mind the cut. There, another saying, though his face was pinched with hunger. A dark, ragged throng they were about the glowing fire, with the tall, dense jungle pressing close about them. Exhausted with their awkward capering, they would sit to hear the stories of other lands. Once I told them of King Arthur and the Round Table, of Elaine floating down to Camelot, of Excalibur. When I finished, the knights in shining armor and their caparisoned steeds were still there, but the fire had sunk to warm white ashes. That's an example of some of the camaraderie that she would tell stories about. But a lot of the humor comes out through kind of extensive dialogue, and in that way, it really is like kind of like a screenplay, and it's fun to read.
Yes, I agree. And as a like you said, a writing instructor yourself, and in addition to a writer and creative, you mentioned dialogue. What other techniques stand out to you in Panaleo's craft that you would, I don't know, perhaps emulate or cite as, to some of your students, like this is a good example of so and so. Like so what are those, any of those sort of literary techniques that she uses that really you think she does very well or that stand out to you?
There are many things that I would
Yeah.
use to teach. I mean, we just talked about dialogue, and so I'll just reiterate that piece. The dialogue, it is so natural, and you also really get the sense of the different characters based on their different ways that they speak through the dialogue. And this doesn't feel caricatured. So I think that there's a lot to learn there for how nonfiction writers can create more of a sense of that dynamism and dialogue in nonfiction. And so there's quite a lot of what she conveys through dialogue that can feel like fiction because of the great amount of detail that's in the dialogue. And I mean, I don't think every writer would necessarily want to have that much dialogue. There's quite a lot of dialogue in this book, but I think that also is a strategic craft choice by her because it makes something that can feel so distant and dehumanizing really come alive. So that's number one. Another thing is that, and this is actually another thing that really influenced my book because I always knew it was something I was trying to do, which is transition seamlessly between micro and macro. So being able to transition between a very close-in scene that shows, say, the relationship between her and some of the other guerrilla fighters, or her and her commander lover, and then being able to transition seamlessly into these exposition moments from scene to exposition that give context to the political dynamics going on in Manila in relationship to the Japanese and in relationship to the Americans who had retreated to Australia. She's able to go back and forth like that really seamlessly. And while I found myself always wanting even more of that context in the parts that she does it, I think she does it really well, and it doesn't feel jarring. Another thing I had just mentioned, exposition, is that in her exposition, there are cases where it's kind of mind-blowing to me how much information she's able to compress into a paragraph. So that's another thing that I would teach is just take some of those paragraphs as examples of compression and effective compression, and how each sentence can convey an entire complex trend. And then she moves on to the next trend to then be able to explain, there's a paragraph that is, I feel like there's probably it could warrant an entire history book. And in one paragraph, she describes these essentially political dynamics between the acting president, who history has pretty much deemed a puppet president of the Japanese, and another Filipino actor who was, aligning himself more with the American government, right? And so it just incredible, brilliant compressed exposition. What else? I think that there's, I mean, Denise Cruz, I had wanted to quote her on this, because in her introduction, she writes that Panlilio blends wry commentary with rigorous journalistic detail and popular romance conventions. So in terms of style, right, it's not just the micro to macro transitions that's amazing, but also this blending of styles. And I would add to that she, meaning Panlilio, also is very effective at doing like fiction level tension in nonfiction, right? So like John Grisham style tension, right? Where chapters where I was holding my breath because I was rooting so hard for this regiment of guerrillas to escape an encirclement of soldiers, or, wondering whether, this person who might be a spy was actually a spy or not. So I think that can be a real challenge, I think, for nonfiction writers. It's I think the driving force of fiction. But sometimes nonfiction, we get caught in like, well, we're just trying to share, we're trying to share some facts or some brilliant ideas, And then we get, but how do you actually make that compelling? And so there's some really great examples of how to do that in scene and exposition. I think the last couple things that I'll say about craft, although I could probably geek out about this for hours, is that he has some really interesting examples of playing with time. So even though most of this book is very close in narration, as if it's happening in the present, there are some moments where she chooses to flash forward. And it creates this very poignant effect of, oh my gosh, in this moment, these poor folks trapped in this war, they couldn't foresee what was going to happen. And so she's like, let me tell you what happened later. And actually, do we have time for me to read an example of that?
Oh, yes, please do. Yeah.
Because I think that it is a really good example of a writing trick that can be really powerful. So this is a moment where one of the other women in the guerrilla involved in the guerrilla outfit, because another thing that Panaleo does is really create show the sense of sisterhood among other women. There were few, but they were there who supported the guerrillas in some way. And in this example, it's someone who actually did come and live and support the guerrillas day in and day out. But her husband had gone missing. And so this is a moment where they still don't know what had happened to the husband. And this woman's name is Lyd. So they're talking, and Lyd doesn't want to answer them. They're talking about her husband Manuel's fate. And then Panlilio writes, after the liberation, Lyd was to kneel and touch with her small, warm hands the cold block of paving stone, miraculously unshattered in the ruins. Upon which, in the months in old Bilibid, which was a prison, Manuel had scratched for her his name. She was to walk, walk, question, walk, and with her whole searching being, listen for a word, any word. The truck filled with black-hooded doomed prisoners leaning weakly against one another, sustaining one another. Yes, oh yes, one had slipped his hood, worked it loose by rubbing cheek against shoulder, and disclosed a large bluish black birthmark on the side of his face, which an acquaintance among the pedestrians had seen. It was a message for Lyd to tell her which way he had gone. She was to learn that a humble gravedigger, risking his life, scattered straw about the mouth of the great pit. August 30, 1944. And she was finally to say, this was he. There were no tears for Manuel nor for Lyd, who intimately knew his greatness. There were tears only for a world which lost him. Those things were in Lyd's future when we named the camp for Manuel. They were the terrors which sucked the breath out of her lungs at night. The churning days swept on. So, again, an example of choosing, right, to share some future information in order to give some additional, I think, poignancy to the moment that she was describing in the present.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, and it's an interesting way of understanding the present by knowing what's coming in the future also kind of helps the reader kind of get in the heads of the characters there, the real people, not characters, but yes. We mentioned the when the book came out in 1950, The Crucible, and you've also mentioned Panlilio's journalistic work as well. And I want to quote from again from Denise Cruz in the introduction. Denise writes, ever the consummate journalist, Panlilio published The Crucible with clear objectives. to publicize the important yet unrecognized contributions of the guerrilla resistance in the war against Japan, to recognize the role of Filipinas in wartime efforts, and to articulate a nationalist formation of mestiza Filipina identity. So with those objectives in mind, well, I guess first, would you agree with that assessment of the Crucible?
Well, Professor Cruz would know best about Panlilio's actual intentions.
That's true, yeah.
And when I read that, it's funny, I was going to quote that as well. doing that. And when I read that in the introduction, I felt really proud. I was like, oh, great. Well, that's why I want to read it, because, you know, I want to understand more about the guerrilla resistance. There's not that much written about it. And my grandfather was a guerrilla during the war, which I write about in Nervous. But it's very hard to find a lot of details about what had happened, unless you go into military archives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I am glad that that was her intention, as Cruz had uncovered. I just am sad that I think that she was fairly thwarted in that intention, because since the original publication, and Cruz writes about this, her work fairly sank into obscurity. And Cruz writes about different varying reasons for why that might be. And I have some theories about that as well. But it's all the more reason that I'm really grateful for this reissued edition, because it gives us all an opportunity to rediscover her work, which I would hope would come to be considered as a great example of American historical memoir.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Because, like you mentioned it as well, it serves as a primary document as well of that time, and not in addition to being a very well written and memoir that is enjoyable to read as well. So it like really serves that purpose of informing us what the guerrillas were up to in those times, and like you said, the day to day life, which is so important but often overlooked in these historical moments of how are the people living on a day to day basis. So I think it does serve very, very good role in that. And as you were reading Panlilio and writing Nervous, you mentioned some of the sort of literary aspects that you took away from it, as well as the courage. Did you feel any sort of connection to it I don't know if metaphysical is the right word way, but any sort of like, I don't know, anything like that?
I did feel a connection to it. I am so glad you asked that question, because it's giving me a chance to really reflect on that in a way I don't think I have before, because, you know, I was looking for inspiration, like I'd said, in an example, but I think I really did personally connect with her sense of justice and her sense of commitment to a cause. I also identify with her sense of being in between, which honestly she drew a lot of I think her bravery from, right? She was in between in the sense of race, right? She was Filipina and Irish. She was in between in the sense of national identity, and that she was American, born in America, and yet she lived quite a bit of her life in the Philippines. And she was in between also in terms of gender. And I definitely identify with that. I identify as a non-binary femme. And while she, you know, didn't live in a time where there was that type of terminology, I think she quite lived like a non-binary person, not just in the way that she upset gender roles, although she does also embrace this identity of guerrilla mother. And then unfortunately, you know, also describes quite disturbing relationship that can sometimes be violent with her commander lover. Overall, she occupies a space which I think is really hard to categorize in terms of gender, while at the same time being pretty unapologetically feminist. And so that's something that I aspire to. So I think I identified with that. And I would hope that readers of any identity, you know, would come to this book and just be able to see a writer who was at once a product of her time. You know, it wasn't actually that unusual, relatively, for women to be reporters at that time. I've seen a statistic that says that, you know, a full 25% of the journalism profession was women at the time. So she's a product of her time, but at the same time, you know, she's a Filipina American woman from Denver who went to the Philippines and asked, how can a Filipino American contribute to the war effort against Japan? And then spent 3 years in the mountains with guerrilla fighters. Like, there's obviously a beyond at that point, the identification stops because that's just so unique. But I think I do feel also this sort of larger sense of pride of being connected in lineage in some way to somebody who was so boundary breaking and fearless and had talent in the way that she wrote to tell about it.
Yes, well said. It's interesting. I was about to ask, like, you know, how would Panlilio be engaging with our current world? But I feel like she is, because we're talking about her, you know, in a way. But if you want to do the little thought experiment, like if she were alive today, you know, what do you think she'd be doing?
You know, my first thought that comes to mind around that is I think that she'd be like an Instagram star.
Yeah.
I think she would be, right? She'd be wearing her white shark suit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
She'd be a total influencer. She'd be one of those independent journalists like Bianca Gralau in Puerto Rico, or Bisan in Palestine, who is just reporting independently, calling it like it is, doing cool multimedia visuals with maps and good analysis. I absolutely see her doing that. And then, you know, she would be doing a dispatch on Instagram, and meanwhile, like, her three kids would be popping up on screen, you know, like Instagram bombing her because she was also a mother of three. I also like to think about her as continuing to write. She was a broadcast journalist, but she was also obviously a writer. And she wrote a column after the war, pretty much until she died. You know, she wrote this book. There's just one little line that's easy to miss in the actual body of the book, not in the introductions, where she talks about how she wrote this book to feed her children. Right. So you think about it, it's after the war. She's pretty much destitute, right? She grew up working class, but she's come back after the war and she's relying on the US government putting her up in a Red Cross, in Red Cross housing. And so she wrote this book as not just art and documentation and political reparation, as Denise Cruz had said, but as a form of labor, as a form of labor. And so I think that she would be continuing to labor. She'd be continuing to write. And I like to think of her as maybe being like a columnist or something, you know, for the New Yorker, like Gia Tolentino, and writing really amazing wry commentary on being mixed race and transnational feminism, American foreign policy, things like that.
Yeah, I could totally see that as well. And we've kind of covered this one as well, but why would you recommend people read Panlilio today? For me, it was to get an understanding and introduce myself to the guerrilla efforts, you know, in the Philippines that in my education, not really mentioned that much. So the historical aspect of it, but yeah, wonder if you have any thoughts on why you would recommend people pick up The Crucible and other writings by Panlilio.
Well, there's still more I would want to say about the historical context piece of it, but I'll actually start with the kind of contemporary relevance. So there is just so much writing craft, like I had said, that is really great to learn from this book. I think that anybody who's interested in feminist memoir should absolutely read this book. And then, you know, as a historian myself, I will always say that what we learn about history, it's always connected to what we are living through today. And so on the historical context note, I think that this book is really important to read to understand the importance of the guerrilla efforts to resist the Japanese empire, as you had said. And in an even more broad sense, I think it's a really important way to understand wars that we are unfortunately continuing to face today, and in particular, colonial and imperial wars across the globe. And there's a couple other pieces of historical context that might not be actually as obvious because she doesn't write about them specifically. But in writing about guerrilla fighters in the Philippines at this time, and also in writing about the ways, kind of the complex interactions between Filipino guerrilla fighters, American soldiers as well, who some of whom took to the hills. There's some really amazing first-person accounts of those types of interactions here. And so number one, there's just a lot of great context to sort of these complicated dimensions of U.S.-Philippine relations that are a really important part of American history and very humanized context. But then even more specifically, there's this other part of hidden American history that's about Filipino American war veterans. And so there were more than 250,000 Filipinos who were recruited to fight for the United States during World War II. And these more than 250,000 soldiers, they fought valiantly and obviously won, right? And they were promised US veteran benefits. Now, the American government broke this promise after the war, because they gave the Philippines their independence and then said, well, now that you're independent, you don't get any benefits from us. And so these veterans, more than 250,000 again, went unrecognized and uncompensated for more than two generations until the Obama administration provided some restitution to the few who were still alive in 2009. So there's, you know, descendants of these veterans who are still living with that legacy here, and they're part of the more than 4 million Filipino Americans in the United States. And so this book gives some context to what some of those soldiers actually had to live through, those that survived, right? And then what happened in the aftermath, right? And it's all just very, I think, important human level stories about American-Philippine relations, as I had said before. But then there's also Pen Lilio herself, right? So I think that this book is important to read because, okay, so let me put it this way. It's important to read as kind of a seminal piece of war literature, almost at the level of John Hersey's Hiroshima, right? We all know that book, and for good reason, right? That is some of the best journalistic writing on war, and humanitarian journalistic writing, right? So this book is relevant because of that. And also, Pen Lilio wasn't just a writer, right? She was a important war figure as well herself. And most people don't know that she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom because of her wartime activities. And so she was, you know, recognized for her military involvement as well as being a decorated journalist. So many reasons. So many reasons for this book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you stressed the human aspect of it as well, because, you know, we can, you know, read, like you said, government reports and things like that, but adding that, like Hersey does in Hiroshima as well, that really the individual effects of war on people is important to remember.
Cruz kind of theorizes some of the reasons why this might have fallen into obscurity. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, Hiroshima, since I just mentioned it, there are some things in this book that are worth, you know, critiquing and that are slightly problematic and that should be seen as a product of its time, right? Including the way that you know, quote unquote, Japs are portrayed, including the way that indigenous people in the Philippines are portrayed. And so, you know, it's not a perfect book, but I think that we know how to read books you know, in the context of their time. And so I think her book should be given that generosity of framework as well.
Yeah, and even with those, to better understand the time, right? Those sentiments that are perhaps problematic are also good to delve into and understand why they were in that way. But yes. So as we're getting close to wrapping it up here, was there anything else that we haven't covered that you wanted to mention about Panlilio or any other projects you have coming up?
I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity and to thank the American Writers Museum for the work that you do. As a historian, I'm real big on documentation and on sharing, you know, legacies. And so the way that you're doing that for writers specifically is so important, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we appreciate you writing. But like I said, listeners, there's a link in the episode description to check out Jen's book, Nervous: Essays on Heritage and Healing. I've been reading it. I highly recommend it as well. You'll learn a lot of history, as well as the, like we've been talking about Panlilio, the micro stories as well, and you'll laugh probably. So definitely recommend checking it out.
Love that.
Yeah. Well, Jen, thank you for joining me today, and can't wait to read what you have coming out next.
Oh, thank you. Me too. I'll keep working at it.
Perfect.
All
Awesome.
right. Thanks for your work, Nate.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.